A mini creep should just be us reading boy band lyrics, like, just like monotone, no context, and just rate them on how absolute cringy and inappropriate it was. Like, I was singing that in sixth grade.
If we get 5, baby, when the lights go out. Baby, when the lights go out.
Okay, that's nothing on Liquid Dreams, O-Town. Whoa. Yes. I'm like, what's a Liquid Dream? Yeah.
Welcome to another episode of True Crime Creepers, where we talk about all the real-life creeps, from serial killers to con artists. I'm Kristen, the true crime fanatic who loves to tell these stories.
And I'm Mo Gap, the true crime newbie who hasn't heard any of them.
Oh man, am I excited to be talking about this one today?
Yeah, you did tell me that.
We're talking about boy bands.
Yes, I need this so bad. I've had a terrible week. Bye, 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 bye. Tell me.
That exact digital, song digital comes up in down. This.
Oh.
Just you and me.
With me. Remember that song? How cringy. Yes. That one makes me really uncomfortable.
It's terrible. Well, big thanks to the Vanity Fair article, Mad About the Boys, as well as the Vanity Fair Confidential episode on ID, based on the article. As well as the documentary produced by Lance Bass called The Boy Band Con. Because today,
we're talking... You know, he was my crush?
Lance Bass?
Yeah, I was devastated when I found out I was not his type.
Sorry. Because today, we're talking about one of the biggest con artists in the world, and one that had a huge personal impact on me and my life. And that would be Mr. Lou Pearlman. Now,
I definitely know that name.
You definitely do.
Was he like a manager or something?
He sure was. And how many, let me just ask you a question right now. Think of any other person you've ever been a fan of, any other musical artist you've ever been a fan of.
Got a whole list.
Can you name a single one of their managers?
Just Taylor Swift, but that's because of all that. But no, basically.
Yeah. But like, why do we know Lou Pearlman? Well, I'll tell you.
Did Bob Marley have a manager? That was the first person that popped in my head. I was like,
I'm sure
Marley.
He did, but
who are you? Like, if you're Bob Marley's manager, I have a lot of questions I'd love to ask you.
All right. Well, February 17th, 1998 was a very big day for 12-year-old Kristen. Okay.
Tell me.
You could say that it was the day that my life changed forever. Forever. At the time.
This is the best story yet.
Look, at the time, I was a big fan of the Backstreet Boys. Quit Playing Games With My Heart was on constant repeat. My room was covered in Backstreet Boys paraphernalia.
Tiger Beat, the posters from the magazines.
Oh, yeah. Brian Luttrell was the dream. But then February 17th, 1998 came around. That was the day that NSYNC's first single, I Want You Back, was released in the United States. And the first time I heard that song, no guarantees it was on that day, but, you know, we're working with estimates here. The first time I heard that song, I was obsessed. I mean, I just heard that song
changed?
One time.
Were you conflicted? Were you
No, not at all. The Backstreet Boys came down, just torn off the walls.
Yeah.
NSYNC was up. My love for Brian Luttrell was replaced with a deep obsession with JC Chassé.
Wait. Was Brian the redhead?
There was a redhead?
I'm going to look because I think our Backstreet Boys crush is the same.
Well, he was the cutest one, so.
Yeah. Is it Brian from, people are screaming.
I wouldn't call Brian him a redhead. Backstreet.
Oh, this is who I'm thinking of. Would I kind of thought that was like red? Reddish. Oh,
okay. All right.
No, I don't know. He's definitely the one I was thinking of.
Yeah. Okay. Well.
Wow. We had the same Backstreet Boys crush. Glad that didn't translate to NSYNC because I would fight you for Lance Bass. Like,
no, JC Chassé. Oh my gosh. Framed photos on my walls. It was a whole thing. And it wasn't just me, okay? I don't think an episode of TRL on MTV existed where NSYNC and Backstreet Boys weren't going toe-to-toe for the number one spot. I watched it every day. And if NSYNC lost, it would ruin my day. Okay. I guess it was like sports fans when their favorite team loses, but I wouldn't know. I was not a sports fan. I was an NSYNC fan.
It is similar, yeah.
And you could not be both. You could not be both a Backstreet Boys and an NSYNC fan.
Yeah. Yeah, you had to pick.
You had to choose. My best friend at the time was a Backstreet Boys fan, and I'm pretty sure that's why our friendship fizzled out by the ninth grade.
But JC is cute.
He's fine. Oh,
I feel like I was just, I was really had blinders on. I did not understand the Justin Timberlake love.
Well, behind JC's beautiful blue eyes and Justin Timberlake's ramen noodle curls, there was a boy band mastermind. A puppeteer, if you will.
If you don't think I'm going to post a picture of ramen noodles Justin Timberlake side by side on our Instagram, the poll.
It's been done. Like, the meme is out there. I did not make that up. No.
Oh, my God.
I would love to take credit for that, but I was not the one to notice.
That's amazing.
There was a boy band mastermind, a puppeteer, if you will, responsible for the creation and success of not just NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys, but basically all of the other 90s boy bands like O-Town and LFO, who were my second favorite, because Backstreet Boys couldn't be my second favorite because I couldn't also like them. So LFO was my second. The amount of Abercrombie & Fitch I wore because they like girls who wear Abercrombie & Fitch, I swear to God.
You are outing yourself so hard right now.
Oh, middle school Kristen was this girl.
I'm glad I met you in college, but I would have loved to have met you when you were 12.
I really wasn't that much better in college. Anyway, that person, that criminal mastermind, that puppeteer, or boy band mastermind, that puppeteer, his name was Lou Pearlman. And being the NSYNC Uber fan that I was, I always knew who Lou Pearlman was. There was no denying that Lou had a talent for finding talent and marketing the hell out of it. He was instrumental in turning Orlando, Florida into the capital of pop music. He sold 45 million records. And in the late 90s and early aughts, he was basically the king behind the curtain. Though he really wasn't that much behind the curtain because we both knew who he was. And that to me is odd. Mm-hmm. And we'll get into more of that later. But
yeah, I mean, I knew who he was.
Yeah, exactly. He was creating and launching bands that spurred absolute mania in preteen and teenage girls and gays like nothing that had ever been seen before, since like the Beatles and Elvis, probably. Yeah. That's citation needed, but probably.
Citation needed.
Now, I knew who Lou Pearlman was, but what I didn't know was what a total piece of garbage he was. He was a liar, a con artist, a thief, and a predator. Aww. And nobody ever suspected or knew a thing until 2006, when the empire Lou Pearlman had spent decades building all began to crumble down. It was around 7 p.m. on November 11th, 2006, when police in Orlando, Florida were called after some concerned neighbors heard a car running inside a closed garage. Police arrived and opened the garage to find a white 1987 Porsche with the engine running. Inside the car was the body of 45-year-old Francisco Vasquez Jr. with a t-shirt wrapped around his head. Francisco, or Frankie, was Lou Pearlman's oldest childhood friend. They'd grown up in the Mitchell Gardens apartments in Flushing, Queens, where Frankie's dad was the super. He and Lou started working together in the 80s, and at the time of his death, Frankie was heading operations at Transcontinental Records, the label that Lou had started when he formed the Backstreet Boys. Everyone wondered what could have possibly pushed Frankie to the point of taking his own life. But family and friends knew exactly why Frankie had decided to end his life. Recently, he'd been absolutely distraught after losing his entire life savings, because he had entrusted it to the person he was most loyal to in this world, his oldest friend, Lou Pearlman.
Isn't Lou like swimming in cash? Like the little, the duck? What is it? From the...
Oh, Scrooge McDuck. He just is diving into all his piles of gold. Yeah, basically. That's basically Lou Pearlman, Scrooge McDuck.
What?
Except not as stingy. He spends his gold way faster than Scrooge McDuck ever would. Lou was born in 1954, and he grew up a middle-class Jewish kid in a one-bedroom apartment in Queens, New York, with a father who was in the dry cleaning business and a stay-at-home mother who gave Lou the one bedroom while they slept in the living room.
Aww.
As a kid, he was shy, and he didn't really stand out in any way. But at home, he was the shining star in the eyes of his mother, Rainey. He could do no wrong, and she would encourage him that he could do anything. The only problem with that was that he had no visible talent.
You could do anything with limits.
Right. So when he was like in elementary school, his mom started giving him $5 to go take guitar lessons at this place down the street. And this is when young Lou started to realize he had quite the eye for business. Some of the younger kids at the Mitchell Gardens apartments also wanted to learn how to play guitar. So Lou would show them what he was learning at his lessons and they would pay him for it. And he was basically doubling the money that he spent on the guitar lessons. That story is told by him. And there's a lot of fabrication and exaggeration. So,
oh, I'm sure.
Take that little story of his, you know.
I'm sure.
Adventures in entrepreneurship with a grain of salt. But one thing that was true was that his first cousin happened to be Art Garfunkel of Simon and Garfunkel.
Oh my gosh.
And Lou grew up watching as his cousin grew to be one of the best-selling music groups of the 60s and of all time. After their electronic remix of The Sound of Silence went the 60s version of viral. They had hit after hit after hit. They won Grammy after Grammy. And their final album, Bridge Over Troubled Water, became the number one album for 3 years in a row. And at the time, really? Yes, that was the best-selling album of all time until Thriller beat it 10 years later.
I didn't know an album could do like 3 years in a row. Like just
I didn't either. But I mean, the 60s were also a totally different time. I mean, absolutely different than it is now. But yeah, I wouldn't think. And I don't know if it was like, yeah, the number one album for 3 years in a row. I mean, I read that somewhere. So look, take it up
this
with
that. This is going to make me sound dumb too, but I just wondered the very first time like streaming downloads and like getting music, you know, off the internet, like the people sitting around the conference table that are like in charge of, you know, when we're a record goes platinum. Yeah. They're like, oh my God, how do we count this? You know?
Well, and the ones that are smart stay ahead of stuff like that and evolve with, that's why Blockbuster is no more and Netflix took off. You know, Blockbuster had an opportunity to get into streaming and they didn't. And they could have been the biggest streamers on the planet because they had so much customer branding and loyalty. People would have purchased a streaming service with Blockbuster, but
yeah,
they weren't able to make the transition.
I do miss like going on the shelves and like the little cases, like the little cover and like seeing if the movie was behind it.
Yeah.
If they tried to come back, people would definitely go for the nostalgia.
Yeah, I feel like they would. Well, Lou watched all this happen with his cousin Art. And he started dreaming about a music career for himself. But even with his guitar lessons, he would never have the talent to recreate his cousin's success. That was okay, though, because when he was 10 years old, he developed another obsession. Blimps.
What?
Blimps.
Like the sub sandwiches, Blimpy? Or like the actual blimps in the air?
Not Blimpies. Blimps in the air. Mitchell Gardens was across the street from the Flushing Airport, and he and his friend, Alan Gross, they would watch the planes taking off and landing. Well, in 1964, that was the year that the World's Fair was held in New York, and he and Alan watched the Goodyear blimp landing at the airport, and Lou was very intrigued. He tells this story about how he went over to the airport to the people flying the blimp and begged them for a ride in it, but they said that it was only for special guests and journalists. So Lou went to school and he got the school newspaper to give him an assignment to write about the blimp. And he went back to the Goodyear blimp and said he's a journalist now. And they gave him a ride.
Do we think that's true? Blimps are weird.
According to Lou, he started spending all his time at the airport. He'd go after school. He'd go in the summers, helping around the hangars. He became like the unofficial mascot. But according to his friend Alan, it wasn't like that at all. It was actually Alan who had run to the airport to befriend the blimp pilots. And it was Alan who got the press pass. And he said it was he who got the job as a gopher in the blimp's hangar. And mostly Lou was just hanging out at Alan's apartment, which had a clear view of the airport from Alan's living room window. Lou lived on the other side of the apartment complex, so he couldn't see the airport from his window. they'd set up stools and put plates on the windowsill, and they would like sit there and eat snacks and watch the blimps at the airport, which would come back every summer for years and years. Occasionally, he'd tag along with Alan when he went to the hangar for this like gopher job that he finagled for himself. Mm-hmm. But mostly he would just stand around and like stare, and he would make the blimp guys really uncomfortable. And Alan told him he'd have to stop staring or he wouldn't be able to come with him anymore.
I can't wait to see how this is going to tie in. I feel like I'm listening to two very disconnected stories right now.
I know, truly. This is when Lou started to come out of his shell a little. And Alan said that sometimes he feels like the Dr. Frankenstein that created the monster.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, after seeing the Goodyear blimp, Lou had a new dream to have a blimp company. After he graduated high school, he enrolled in Queens College and pursued a degree in accounting. Is that where Hamilton went? Queens College. Anyways. He pursued a degree in accounting. One class he took had him write up a business plan, and he went with a plan for a commuter helicopter service, which honestly sounds amazing. Like, could you imagine? Think of the amount of people that like live in the suburbs and commute into the city for work. And instead of taking a bus, a bunch of people just pool together for a helicopter ride above all the traffic into the city.
That is crazy. I would not.
Oh, I would for 100%.
Of course you would. You want to like never wear pants, wait in line, and ride a magic carpet. Your life is frivolous. You're drinking canned water.
Miss works from home and hasn't had a commute in like 5 years.
And I miss it. That's why. No, I commute every morning to Starbucks and it is costing me way too much.
Okay.
I truly miss an office. But
after he graduated in 1976 with his accounting degree, he started looking for investors for his helicopter company. He ended up talking a group of Wall Street bros that lived on Long Island to buy a helicopter, which Lou then leased from them, and he flew it around New York. And he says in his book that it was this company that he made his first million at 21. But Vanity Fair says this is, at best, doubtful.
Wait, did you read a book for this?
No, Vanity Fair article.
Oh, that's right.
Mm. And I watched two documentaries, okay? And a plethora of other sources that are in the show notes.
You don't have to prove yourself to me. You know who's wondering.
So that company, this helicopter company, ended up merging with a competitor. And Lou once again turned his sights to his true obsession. Blimps.
Shocked every time.
He had joined an airship fraternity full of people who shared his obsession. They called themselves balloonatics or helium heads. And all the balloonatics knew that the best blimps in the world were built by this German guy's company named Theodor Vollenkemper. Lou found out that Vollenkemper would be in New York, and he decided to shoot his shot. He sent him a birthday card. This birthday card was covered in glitter, and it was 2 feet tall.
Covered in glitter? That's so much glitter.
2 feet of glitter.
I know.
And with the birthday card was an invitation to dinner with him in New York. And Vollenkemper actually accepted this invitation. Lou was beside himself. He picked Vollenkemper up from the airport in a helicopter, and he took him to dinner at a really fancy place. His apartment at Mitchell Gardens, his mother hosted.
Oh, this is becoming the weirdest story you've told me. And this is a crime podcast, like a murder podcast. And I'm feeling very uncomfortable about
this
whole thing.
No murder, but the crimes, they are a coming. But Vollenkemper loved Lou's enthusiasm for blimps, and he invited him to come to Germany to train at his facilities there. And so Lou brought along Frankie Vasquez, who was another Mitchell Gardens resident, and they went to Germany for a time to train at this facility about blimps. Once Lou got back to the States in 1980, he was ready to start his blimp business. He called it Airship Enterprises LTD. And he started shopping this around to corporate sponsors who might want to lease a blimp for promotional purposes. And he found one company that was interested. It was the Jordache Jeans Company.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they wanted to hire him to fly a blimp with their logo on it over a party that they were having in Lower Manhattan. And this was awesome. Lou was finally going to live his dream of owning a blimp business. The only problem was He did not have a blimp. And he had no money to buy a blimp.
But so that was he like selling to these companies? Like,
he,
I mean, how is he getting like
Jordache? He didn't have a blimp.
Right.
Like, they didn't know he didn't have a blimp. They thought he had a blimp. He didn't. But that wasn't going to stop him, MoGap. He managed to get a used envelope of a blimp, which is like the outside, like the balloon part, mm-hmm. I guess. And then he hired a contractor to build the frame for it inside. It was put together at the same naval base in New Jersey where the Hindenburg crashed.
Oh, that's like a good sign for sure.
Yeah, it's not foreshadowing at all. So Jordache wanted the blimp painted gold, like real gold. It was like $15,000.
Like a Notre Dame football helmet? Get out of here. Yeah.
And then, so they painted it like $15,000 of gold paint. Then it had the big horse, like the Jordache horse, and it said Jordache across it. But after several days sitting in the sun at the airport, the gold turned brown, and Alan Gross said it just looked like a giant turd.
Oh, I hate that word.
Yeah. But
I would put that on the Mount Rushmore. Right next to commode. A turd in the commode. I cannot handle that. Gross.
But, well, and this giant turd had a party to go to.
It.
And that party was on October 8th, 1980.
Do you realize what you just said? This gets recorded and people listen to it. You said this turd has a party to go to.
Well, it did. It was October 8th, 1980. This was the inaugural flight of Lou's blimp. It was to fly from New Jersey to New York Harbor, which is not a far flight, but still much too far for this blimp.
Because it doesn't work.
It didn't even make it out of the naval base before the pilot was forced to crash land in a garbage dump.
Oh my gosh, is he okay?
Yeah, everybody was fine. Nobody was hurt except for the blimp. And Lou blamed the disaster on the weight of the paint. But most people thought that Lou had never actually intended to ever fly this blimp. First of all, Lou hadn't flown the amount of practice runs that are required by federal law, nowhere near that amount, actually, which meant that if the blimp had gotten off of the naval base, Lou could have been arrested.
Hmm.
So why would Lou plan to crash his own blimp? Insurance money.
Insurance,
of course.
Money. I'm so good at this.
Yeah, he had insurance on this blimp, and his insurer took him to court, and the litigation lasted 7 years, but Lou walked out of there with a $2.5 million settlement. He probably paid a couple hundred thousand dollars for the blimp because it was just the envelope and then the contractor to build it, and now he's made $2.5 million on it.
And Jordache paid for, like, the paint and the brand, all that stuff, right?
I don't know if Jordache, like, if they ever paid him or not. I'm not sure. Once it crashed, that was probably, he probably mm-hmm. would have had to give all the money back, you know? Anyone that knows me knows I'm obsessed with hair care and more recently skincare. But it is so overwhelming. It's hard to even know where to begin. And I hear about all these custom beauty products promising to fix my dry hair and scalp, my damaged ends. But then I find out that after you take some quiz to get it personalized, it turns out they're just sending you some pre-made formula that's not actually personalized. Well, that is not the case with Pros. Pros is here to make all your hair care and skincare wants and needs so easy. And it's actually personalized. Each and every bottle of Pros custom hair and skincare is made to order and personalized with a unique blend of naturally powerful and proven effective ingredients to meet your needs. Nothing is pre-mixed and straight off the shelf, and it's actually effective. In a third-party, double-blind, dermatologist-supervised, controlled clinical study, aka the gold standard in research studies, Pros proved that personalization works better than products straight off the shelf. You can try it for yourself and get your healthiest hair in 30 days or get your money back. In fact, Pros is so confident that you'll love your results that they're offering our listeners an exclusive trial offer so that you can see the difference that custom care can make. 50% off your first subscription order at pros.com/creepers. That's PROSE.com/creepers for your free consultation and 50% off of your one-of-a-kind formula. PROSE.com/creepers. So now he's got the money to buy a blimp that's actually going to fly. And that's exactly what he does. He starts a new company. No more Airship Enterprises. Now it's Airship International. And throughout the 80s, he started buying up blimps, somewhere around like 5 or 6 of them, that he'd lease out to companies for promotional stuff. Everyone from McDonald's to SeaWorld was leasing blimps from him. And he spent the next decade continuing to grow and grow and grow. By 1989, he was living in a penthouse apartment in Queens with a 6,000 square foot vacation home in Orlando, renting office space on Fifth Avenue, driving around in a Rolls Royce, flying around in a rented Learjet for every business trip. In 1991, he moved the headquarters of Airship International to Orlando, and he took his closest associates, including Frankie Vasquez, with him, with the promise that he was going to make Frankie rich. Make them all rich. By this time, he'd also started an airline that he called Transcontinental Airlines, which had a fleet of over 40 jets and an annual revenue of $80 million.
My God.
But the way Lou was spending money, it wasn't enough. So
how is that not enough?
Well, I mean, it's not $80 million in profit, but still. Yeah. He was just spending money, spending so much money. So he started courting investors, looking like the aviation impresario with 2 successful aviation companies. And these investors weren't all rich corporate Shark Tank types. Some kind of were, like Joseph Chow, who was a millionaire engineering professor in Illinois, who would end up lending Lou over $14 million. Or the Sarin family, who would invest over $12 million over the next 15 years. But some of these people were just like retirees in Florida with a little nest egg that they wanted to bet on a sure thing.
Yeah. Oh, so sad.
Yeah. But by the early 90s, his obsession with the blimps was fading. He was ready for the next big thing. New Kids on the Block had blown up in the late 80s. And by the early 90s, they were one of the most popular musical acts in the United States. Just hit after hit after hit.
Kind of forget about them. Because it was like a little...
It was like right before our time, yeah.
Yeah. But they did a like reunion concert recently and people were like...
I think they go on tour with Backstreet Boys. It's like New Kids on the Block and the Backstreet Boys, yeah. Lou watched their career boom and he was inspired. I actually thought New Kids on the Block were fake because I only knew of them from a cartoon, a New Kids on the Block cartoon that I would watch.
I remember
and
that.
So I thought they were like a made up band that was just on this cartoon because I was like 8 or so. In 1992, I was 6. So,
yeah.
So in early 1992, Lou put an ad out in the Orlando Sentinel calling for teenage boys to come audition to be part of a band. Orlando, you wouldn't think of it, but it was the perfect place for scouting talent because of all of the amusement parks that it, like the Disney and Universal, it attracted a lot of talented young people that would perform in the shows or be the characters at these parks.
Yeah.
But they had dreams of bigger and better things. So this was a perfect pool to pick from if you're trying to start a pop group. One of the first people to reply to the ad was Denise McLean, mother of AJ McLean, who was like 14 or 15 at this time, and he was an aspiring singer. So he auditioned for Lou in his living room, and Lou loved him, and he became the first member of the band that would become the Backstreet Boys.
I cannot believe that is how that started. Like,
from an ad in a paper, just, like, from Lou Pearlman. Oh, yeah. I know, right? Yeah.
And it's like, now you're, oh my gosh.
Lou continued to have open casting calls looking to fill in the rest of the members. And eventually, he got Brian Luttrell, Nick Carter, Kevin Richardson, and Howie Doro to complete the group.
I cannot believe that.
I know. Well, and Brian was only in it because he's like Kevin's cousin. So he like got brought in that way.
But I like forget. I mean, obviously, you know this. But like when you look at all the posters and stuff, you're like, oh, they're not just like all best friends that just like randomly were all. You know what I mean? Like
I still kind of think of NSYNC that way, at least most of them.
Yeah.
Not one in particular, but there are others. Lou named them the Backstreet Boys after the Backstreet Flea Market in Orlando, which I don't know what that is. I've never been there. I tried to like Google image some stuff, but honestly, what a weird thing to name them after, like a flea market.
Named after flea market? That is so weird.
I know.
But it fit. I mean, Backstreet Boys like sounds cool.
Yeah, it does. Maybe he just saw it and was like, that's a good name. These are the Backstreet Boys. Yeah. These are the Backstreet Boys. They had their first show at SeaWorld in May of 1993. That was their first performance. Oh my gosh. I know. And then they went on a tour of amusement parks and malls. Lou brought in a couple that were professional managers named Johnny and Donna Wright. And within a year under their guidance, the Backstreet Boys were signed to Jive Records and released their first album.
Jive.
It took a few more years to find success in the U.S., but by 1997, they were an absolute sensation. Meanwhile, Lou was basically ignoring his poor blimps.
Oh, poor thing.
The company started just hemorrhaging money, losing millions and millions of dollars every year. Stock prices went from $6 a share to 13 cents. And by 1994, he only had one blimp that was still flying. The others had either crashed or been dismantled. And by 1995, Lou's lease on that last blimp expired and it was all over.
What happens when the lease expires? You like give it back?
I mean, you either renew or, you know, you don't. Yeah. Mm. But his investors didn't seem to care. Like Lou, they were much more excited about the prospects the music industry would bring. And they also felt secure with their investments because even though the blimp business was dead and gone, Lou's airline, Transcontinental, it was thriving. Lou started forming tons of subsidiaries of Transcon Air. The Backstreet Boys were one of them. So were Chippendales, which he acquired in 1996. I had no idea he was an owner of Chippendales. He also formed Transcon Records, Transcon Studios, and Transcon Foods, which was mostly TCBY yogurt franchises and NYPD pizzas.
Yeah. I love TCBY. That white chocolate mousse is so good.
He reportedly spent close to $3 million on the Backstreet Boys before he ever saw a return on that. But he's the one reporting that, so who knows? He saw the potential in the band before they even hit it big, and he was already looking to form more groups. That's where NSYNC came in, which comprised Justin Timberlake, JC Chassé, and what Vanity Fair calls three other singers, which, rude.
Oh my gosh, it's not like... It's not like a band we don't know. Like, you could just... That's that would, right. Terrible.
That would be Joey Fatone, Chris Kirkpatrick, and Lance Bass.
I can't believe Lance got put into that. I understand Joey.
No!
But
what? Joey's great. They were...
me just trying to Google TCBY real quick to see if there's one nearby. There's not. Unfortunately, they're all permanently closed, but...
So, Lou didn't want this, like, Well, he kind of did want this competition with Backstreet Boys and NSYNC, but he didn't really want Backstreet Boys knowing about NSYNC yet because he didn't want them mad at him. So he like shuffled
NSYNC. I didn't
know
they were both under him. Like, this is so interesting.
He created
to
me. Both of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm. So they were sent to Europe. He like sent NSYNC off to Europe in 1995 to do a tour there. That's kind of how they got their start. And soon he had put together another group called Take Five. Later on, he would put together LFO. He put an all-girl group called Innocence together that apparently Britney Spears was in for like 5 seconds. I never knew that.
Ooh, I don't know that name. I was thinking of, what's that one that, he loves me, he loves you,
he loves me
no matter what.
He's into
what
I've got. He loves me, he loves you not.
He loves you not. Who is that? 18s?
No, it's not 18s. Oh, S-Club. Is it S-Club? I loved S-Club.
No, I don't know them.
Dream. That was Dream. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But obviously, out of all these bands, Backstreet Boys and NSYNC were the cash cows for Lou. Mm-hmm. It was a meteoric rise to fame. And he wanted to be seen. He didn't want to just be behind the scenes, riding their coattails. He wanted to be front and center with the bands. Like I said earlier, I can't tell you the manager of a single other band I've ever heard of, but I always knew who Lou Pearlman was. I even knew exactly what he looked like because he was always in pictures with the boys. He wanted the bands to look at him like a father figure. He even asked the Backstreet Boys to call him Big Papa.
Okay, thank God.
Oh, would you? Daddy?
Yeah, ew.
Oh, no.
But he wasn't just a father figure. He controlled them. He was the source of their clothes, their meals, everything. He was powerful. Some described him as a Svengali of boy bands.
Ugh, that word. He's just like a little puppeteer.
I really think that's very accurate. Yeah. And these were teenage boys. I think Chris Kirkpatrick and Kevin Richardson were around 23 in 1995, and they were all far older than the other boys in the bands. Justin Timberlake and Nick Carter were 14 and 15. And
they were hanging out with 23-year-olds? I didn't realize there was such an age gap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's like Chris and Kevin. They're like the older brothers, you know?
Yeah, but band. I'm just like, you could like go drink at a bar and you're in a band with a 14-year-old. I mean, that's weird.
Yeah, I don't know. And most of the time, their parents weren't around. Like, they trusted, their parents were trusting Lou to take care of them. But Lou was just a predator wanting to hang out with good-looking boys that were dependent on him. Over the summer of 1998, Lou was planning yet another band, O-Town. It was still over a year, like almost 2 years before the show Making the Band would air on MTV that documented the formation of the group. And at this time, in 1998, this 20-year-old aspiring singer named Steve Mooney was working at Abercrombie and Fitch. So you know he was good looking if he's working at Abercrombie and Fitch in 1998. Obviously. He was approached by Lou Pearlman's aide, who said that Lou wanted to meet with him. And Steve went to his office and performed a Michael Jackson song. And Lou said he wanted to sign him. He offered him a contract right there for like exclusive artist rights. But he said in the meantime, while the band is being formed, he needed Steve to be his personal driver.
Ew.
And Steve knew that Puff Daddy had originally started out as a driver, and Lou told him that's how JC Chassé had gotten his start as well, which is not true because JC was in the Mickey Mouse Club and he was would never have driven Lou around. I don't know if that's true. I'm just saying. But anyways.
Don't cite this as a source.
Yeah, don't. Citation needed. So Steve agreed to it. He was like, I guess this is normal, is kind of what he's thinking. Like, he doesn't know any better.
Yeah. Right.
So he agreed, and he became more than just his driver. He was taking care of all of his personal errands, taking his phone calls, emptying his trash. If Lou wanted something at 2 a.m., Steve would go get it at 2 a.m. And that was frequent. Steve did it all, basically no questions asked, with the expectation that soon he would be in the band. Lou kept telling him, by this time next year, you'll be a millionaire. I'm giving him too much credit. He sounds too much like Vin Diesel. He was probably like this. By this time next year, you'll be a millionaire. I don't actually remember how he sounded. There are
videos
of him.
You just made him sound like...
Yeah, see? Like,
yeah. I like it.
Lou then asked Steve to move into his house, and Steve agreed.
Okay.
He lived there for
Where's Steve's parents?
Well, he's 20. And yeah. I'll actually tell you where Steve's parents are. This is weird. He lived there for 6 months, working tirelessly for Lou, thinking all the time, the finish line is just around the corner. I just a little bit longer, and all of my dreams are going to come true. This was his one shot to make those dreams come true. But after a while, it started to seem like the price for his music career might actually be higher than he was willing to pay. It started out with little things that Steve was able to just kind of write off. Hugs, shoulder rubs, squeezing his arm. He'd tell him his aura was off and start rubbing his back. He was always asking Steve if he trusted him. Do you trust me? And telling him that he wanted to break him down so that he could build him back up so they could be a team. But then it got weird.
That was already weird.
It got weirder. Anytime they were alone together, Lou would rub Steve's muscles, like just reach over and start rubbing his abs, like, and it would creep Steve out.
Yeah.
Every morning, Lou would come into Steve's room to tell him like what he had to do that day. And it started out like he would come in wearing his robe, which was fine. Steve didn't have an issue with that. But then soon he was just coming in his underwear and sitting on his bed and touching Steve's back to wake him up. And Steve is weirded out. He's creeped out, but he doesn't know if his instincts were right or not. And he's like, I don't want to blow this.
Yeah, well, I'm quit. Reading yeah, it's into my job. This.
Right.
Yeah.
Am I making a big deal out of nothing? Or were all of these moments adding up to one giant red flag? He didn't know. So he asked his dad to come to dinner with him and Lou, to come to dinner with him and Lou. And he wanted to kind of feel his dad's opinion out and see what his dad thought. So Lou spent the entire dinner with his hand on Steve's thigh underneath the table. And Steve's dad walked away from that dinner telling Steve, that guy loves you. and you should do whatever he says.
What?
Steve said that it's weird, but when you start talking about money and fame, it's like Lou had this mind control over people. He's telling Steve's dad what a talent he is and how he's going to make him famous and everybody's going to adore him. And like, that's seductive. Well, then do that
already.
Right. Yeah. Well, then do it. Yeah. But at this point, Lou was just creepy. He too touchy-feely. And the other musicians around Steve were all saying, who cares if you got to let a guy touch you a little bit to make a couple million dollars? Just put up with it. It'll eventually stop when he moves on to someone else. So,
and I can see you justifying that in your mind. Like, there's all these men that are coming in, all these boy bands, and you're thinking, mm-hmm. like, I will eventually, like, be famous.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have it made, and I will be, like, old news.
And at this point, to, like, it's, like, a little inappropriate, non-consensual touching, and maybe I can just, like, deal with that.
Yeah.
You know, if it's just, like, you want to rub my abs, like, okay, then I'll make $1 million in a couple of years, like, you know, I could see somebody making that deal with themselves in their mind of, mm-hmm. I can deal with this. I can hang in there for a little bit longer. Yeah. So Steve shouldn't stuck have around. To. No, absolutely not.
Right.
And that's why things are changing. And that's good. But Steve, so Steve stuck around. He would do whatever Lou wanted him to do. But it all came to a head one night when Lou insisted Steve come over at 2 a.m. So Steve came. He and Lou argued, and finally Steve asked him, what do I have to do to get in this band? And Lou smiled at him and leaned back in his chair, and in the article said he was wearing this white terry cloth robe and tidy whities underneath, and in the episode, Steve said he wasn't wearing anything at this point. Leans back in his chair, spreads his legs, and said, you're a smart boy. Figure it out.
Oh, I'm so creeped out.
And Steve freaked out in that moment. He says he left the house without incident. He, like, walked out. And it wasn't long before he resigned, knowing that he was unwilling to do what it would take. He was frustrated that nobody was talking about what Lou was doing. There was one person in one of Lou's bands that was willing to talk about it. Not at this time, but he did talk about it later on Howard Stern. And that person was Rich Cronin, who was my favorite member from LFO. Rich actually passed away about 13 years ago from leukemia. I was so sad. I was such a big fan of his. In middle school, my friend Monica and I convinced her little sister that he went to our school. Even though he was like 25 at the time. Oh, yeah, that's
so funny. You're like, guess who I saw today?
Yeah. Well, he was my boyfriend.
Oh, of course. Because why wouldn't he be? Obviously.
Right. Exactly.
I didn't know a member of LFO passed away. I always wonder if these guys, I'm like, are they friends? Like, do they still keep in touch?
They were good friends, but yeah.
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 So wait, Lou was doing this to the band members. It wasn't just Steve. Mm-hmm. I mean, I assume not. So like, did members of the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC do? Okay.
Yeah, we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
We could not, though.
Anyway, Rich is the only person from any, like, official band. Take Five, who I've never heard of, they have spoken about some of this, too. We'll get to them, too. But Rich is the only person from one of his, like, big bands that I've ever heard speak publicly about Lou's predatory behavior. The rubbing your abs, touching you. He said on Howard Stern that Lou had some deal, this big deal that was going to make LFO's whole career. And he told Rich that this guy just wanted to touch his penis. Just let him touch your penis. Aww. And then, you know, we'll get this deal and it'll be great.
Yeah, because that's what you need to. Is Take Five a boy band or is it women? Mm-hmm.
Boy band. Okay. Rich said it got to the point where he would just never go with him anywhere alone, and he would just try to avoid him as much as possible. And yeah, just because nobody's talking about it doesn't mean that Rich and Steve were Lou's only victims. Sometime in the 1997 to 1998 period, allegations arose very quietly about something happening with then 17-year-old Nick Carter from the Backstreet Boys. Nick loved going over to Lou's house. It was like a party there all the time. He had like all sorts of toys and stuff. Like it was really fun. But then all of a sudden, he didn't love going over there. Yeah. And this came to light because Nick's parents found out about an incident between Nick and Lou, and they complained. But even to this day, neither Nick nor his mom will discuss what happened. His mom said it nearly broke apart their family, and she used the words sexual predator to describe Lou. So something bad happened, and they don't want to talk about it. But it became like an open secret, you know, the price these young boys were paying for instant fame. And I think I hate it when things are phrased that way because it puts the onus on the young person that's trying to become famous and not the powerful gatekeeper that is making them do that to get what they want. Like, that's not a choice. Everybody's like, well, they made the choice to do that. No, that's not a choice. They shouldn't have ever had to make that choice to make their dreams come true.
You know what? Like, what about the choices we made when we were young? I mean, not like that, but you're holding it to like – these young humans that don't have fully developed brains that are really enticed by something that
even if
would
they're
get
older
most
with
people.
Fully formed well, brains, like if you're willing to do anything and everything, whatever it takes to get what you want, then you're willing to do whatever it takes. And you might not want to do it, but you're willing to do it. The point is, it shouldn't even be an option.
Right.
That should not be something that you have to do in order to get what you want. Like,
absolutely.
I get that, like, yes, not everybody can get what they want. Some people are not going to get what they want. That should not be the thing that stops you from getting there.
Not being willing to perform a sexual favor. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So it was alleged from several people, including Steve Mooney, who saw firsthand the boys going in and out of Lou's bedroom. It was alleged by him and several other people that every band had a sacrifice. One guy in every band who takes it for Lou, that was the words used, who gets along with Lou, who does what Lou wants in the hopes that he'd stay away from the others. So there was Nick from Backstreet Boys, Rich from LFO, and it's alleged that NSYNC's sacrifice was Lance Bass. Probably because Justin Timberlake's mother was so involved with the band, Lou probably didn't even dare try it. And Lance was like the next youngest in the band.
A
member.
It's like a sacrificial lamb in each one.
Yeah. Yep. There was a member from Take Five that talked about some very predatory behavior happening when he was 13 years old. He would sleep over at Lou's house, and Lou showed up at the foot of his bed wearing a towel. And then he like jumped on the bed and started like play wrestling with him until the towel fell off. And this guy was like, I was 13. I was just like, ew, gross, Lou. Like, I didn't know what that was, you know?
Right, right.
Another incident with Take Five was when Lou invited them all over to his house to watch Star Wars in his theater that he had at the house. And then in the middle of the movie, it just switched to a porno. And they're all like teenagers. There were very few willing to say anything about what Lou was doing.
Yeah, also because for so many reasons, I'm sure, but also because it's not just you. Like, they're in a band with other people. This is other people's, like, livelihood.
Well, yeah, considering how much they have to lose, like, it makes sense that most of them wouldn't want to risk it all exposing Lou. Their reputation would go from heartthrob to that boy that was molested. And they were protecting themselves. That's how these powerful predators get away with it for so long, because they know that exposing him could be mutually assured destruction. So you have the very few that are willing to say anything, even now. Others, even today, others just won't talk about it at all, refuse to even discuss it. And then the rest of them will insist that it's all rumors and that they couldn't even imagine Lou ever doing anything like that. Aaron Carter was Lou's most, like, avid, passionate supporter. So passionately talking about how there's no way that Lou would do this. When I could almost guarantee you that that might be what sent Aaron on maybe a little self-destructive path.
Wow.
Citation needed.
Well, we're throwing that out. But I mean, that does make sense.
Yeah. It's sad. It's sad.
It's so sad. This is the worst story.
I know. The boys thought that they
I love
were...
how I was like, oh, boy bands, and I'm devastated.
I know. Now, the boys thought that they're protecting the millions of dollars they would be making. But after a while, they started to notice that they were not making millions of dollars. Originally, when they first started, they'd been happy with like the free hotels and the free meals that they were getting. And they were excited just to get a per diem on top of that. But now they're in one of the biggest bands in the world, selling a record number of albums with their first albums that either of them, Backstreet and NSYNC, released, performing sold-out arena concerts, number one on TRL, and Lance Bass can't even buy a car or afford an apartment in Orlando.
What?
Yeah, so they start wondering where their money is. How is that possible?
Mm-hmm. They always look so rich.
Well, and then Lou made a big deal over NSYNC's like first. Well, that's because Lou was buying them clothes and inviting them over to his house. And so you get the pictures at the mansion, but it's not their mansion. It's his.
Right.
Lou made a big deal over NSYNC's first check presentation. This was when they'd finally get all the money they'd earned from the hours and hours of nonstop rehearsals, performances, album sales. They open their checks all excited, thinking this is all of the money that they've accumulated over all this time, and they're just giving it, they're just going to give it to them in one big batch. And at this time, they had sold over $10 million in album sales. Okay. They were thinking the check was going to be for maybe $1 million, maybe like a quarter of $1 million. They had no idea how much money they were about to walk into. This was going to be life changing. They open it up. It was for $10,000.
What?
$10,000.
Absolutely not. Yeah. That is insane. $10,000?
$10,000. Between 1992 and 1998, the Backstreet Boys, these are the years when they're like the biggest, they only made collectively $300,000. I mean, Quit Playing Games with My Heart came out in 1996. You'd think they'd make more than $300,000 on that song.
That song alone.
And everyone else was getting paid. The promoters were getting paid, the managers, the concert arenas, like everybody else was getting paid. And especially Lou, who made $10 million on the Backstreet Boys during this time period, that getting $300,000.
Shocked. Like, I feel like when I look at them and I'm like, oh, they're so rich, it's because I'm seeing them like selling out these arenas. I just assumed that money was going to them. I mean, I guess I didn't really know, but
it was not.
Does Lou look like a, is he like?
Like a blimp?
Like boy bandy? Oh. No. That's, oh.
No.
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 I was just thinking, like, does he like looks blend like in with these guys?
Thumb. No, he's more thumb-like. You asked, okay? That, I was not describing Lou anywhere. I was being kind, okay? I was not describing him.
I mean, listen, this guy deserves the worst. I was trying to say, like, I mean, I love the physical description. I was, like, trying to see, does he, like, he's not their age, obviously, but does he, like, blend in with them? The answer is obviously no.
No.
Does he look like a turd going to a party?
He had a party to go to. That giant turd had a party to go to. Yeah. Well, it turns out that JC from NSYNC, his uncle was a lawyer, which was really lucky because they had no money to hire a lawyer. So his uncle starts looking over their contract and he tells him that this is one of the worst contracts he had ever seen in the music industry. And he recommended they try to get out of it. Almost all of their money was going to Lou. Everything they earned was his.
Yeah.
Not only was he taking management fees and a percentage, a large percentage of all of the sales of everything, but he was also paying himself as the sixth member of the band.
What? Lou, unless you're up there dancing on stage.
Yeah. Of every band. He was the sixth member of NSYNC, the sixth member of Backstreet Boys. He like put himself in every band and took a sixth member cut on top of his management fees and all of that.
Lou, it's take five, not take six.
So then the guys start to realize, okay, not only am I having to put up with this pervert touching me, but now he's stealing from me.
And right, like now I'm not making the money.
Yeah, and they're pissed. And I think pissed is an understatement. They were hurt. They were so loyal to him. They had a lot of trust and faith in him. He was a father figure to them. And to find out that he was screwing them so royally was terrible for them. All the dinners that Lou had ever treated them to, the house that he'd put them up in, it was all paid for with their money. Without them even knowing it, they'd spent,
it could be their house.
Yeah. They'd spent years thanking this guy for his generosity when he'd been stealing from them this entire time.
Yeah, like you think that you're getting treated so well, but...
Right. So one by one, the bands start either suing him for misrepresentation and fraud or trying to just get just disbanded. NSYNC was originally willing to fix things with Lou to make it fair. If they could make the contract fair, they would stay with him. At this point, this guy's like a family member to them. Like their dad, Big Papa, Papa Lou, you know?
Oh, no. It's like the creepy uncle that's like asking you to 100%. Hug him at Thanksgiving. Yeah,
100%. But they didn't have the discernment at the time, and it's the 90s. Like people just, like, it wasn't talked about. And all the while, he's just been lying to them and stealing from them. And he felt so entitled to all of it. Since he's the one who put them together in the first place, in his mind, that meant he gets everything that they earn. Because if it wasn't for him, they wouldn't have anything in the first place. But they're working their asses off. I mean, they're not just being handed this. Like, they're working.
Yeah, I mean, they're talented.
Yeah, and they're working for hours and hours and hours a day in, like, this airplane hangar with no air conditioning. Rehearsing, learning to dance, learning these songs, like doing it all, and they're not getting paid for it. They were getting paid less than like minimum wage.
So crazy. Like the NSYNC and Backstreet Boys were broke.
I know. It's crazy. What? So they knew if they couldn't get a fair contract, they'd have to get rid of Lou. But it was looking really bad for them at the beginning of all of this. Like there was no way out of this contract. They had two choices, continue with the way it was or leave it all behind. Lou absolutely refused to renegotiate this contract. Wow. But then NSYNC's lawyers found a loophole in the contract that would give them an out. It basically had to do with the contract said they had to be signed with an American company within a certain amount of time. He signed them with this company in Germany and had let that lapse. So it made the contract, it voided it. They were able to get out of it.
Wait, what band was that?
NSYNC. Backstreet Boys? NSYNC. Oh, NSYNC. So they took it. They took that loophole. They took that out. They left for Jive Records. And so then Lou tries to sue them for $150 million. $150 million. These guys, all you've paid them for their entire first album, that I Want You Back. I mean, all these hits on that album, all he's paid them is $10,000. And now he's suing them for $150 million. For breach of contract.
I cannot wait to go add those albums. I don't know why I haven't been streaming that on Spotify, but like tomorrow during the workday, all I'm doing is listening
God
to
the God must have spent a little more time on you.
Yeah. Can't wait to be texting you.
Sailing. Ugh. Okay. Well, then, so he sues them for $150 million for breach of contract. He tried to stop them from using the name NSYNC to perform because he owned the name. But then... the judge saw right through Lou. She said to Lou, okay, so you're saying that you're NSYNC. And here's five guys over here who my daughter has their posters of their faces on her wall. Mm-hmm. And you're saying they are not NSYNC, that you're NSYNC. And she was like, that doesn't make any sense. They win. So they won. NSYNC's next album was called No Strings Attached as a nod to breaking ties with Lou.
And I didn't know that's why.
Mm-hmm, yep, No Strings Attached. Bye, bye. And then, of course, the biggest hit off that album was Bye Bye Bye, which they've said was not about him. They didn't write that song. But come on, I think in a way when they sang, I don't want to be a fool for you in this, like, I don't want to be a fool in this game with you, they're thinking about Lou, you know?
Yeah. I mean, even if it's not about them, you're not singing that and
not thinking about
it. It's a metaphorical middle finger, and you know it.
It's a metaphorical middle finger. That's exactly what it is. Backstreet Boys went a little different way. They basically put I don't really understand how this worked, but basically they put all this money into escrow with a sixth of it set aside for Lou, the sixth member of the band, and they were able to break ties with him that way. I guess that let them get out of their contract. Meanwhile, Lou buys a $4 million gigantic mansion and puts all his time and energy into saving what's left of his empire. Including the aviation enterprises, which were still supposedly...
I thought you were going to say blimp instead of a mansion. That's what I was hoping for.
He's over the blimps, but he's got this airline, which was making record profits. He did Making the Band on MTV after that was after all of this had happened. Was him. Yeah, and that was him putting together O-Town. He was still chugging along, you know, he still had all the power and he did the same stuff with O-Town. And O-Town knew about it. Like they knew about this stuff with NSYNC and Backstreet Boys. They knew that they had left. But at the same time, they also knew the fame that NSYNC and Backstreet Boys had gotten. And they credited Lou for that. And they were like, he can get me there too. And
yeah, you also kind of don't care because you don't know probably about the other skeezy stuff right. yet.
And they're like, how many other opportunities am I going to get? Right. I could turn this down and it could not be like the thing I'm hoping for.
Yeah.
But I could at least go for it and take the opportunity. Yeah. I think that's what they were thinking.
And make a song called Liquid Dreams.
Yeah, but there's a reason they only had like two hits and then they went away. You know, they never really...
Their first album, that one album was good though.
It was good, yeah. Then in 2004, Joseph Chow died of pancreatic cancer. If you remember, he was one of Lou's earliest investors in the aviation business. By this time, he had invested something like $17 million in Lou's aviation company. So his family is now having to go through his investments and get the money out. And so they look into this investment with Transcon, with the Transcontinental Airs, and they call up Transcon asking for their money back. They're trying to get their investments back, right? Out of like, take what you've earned from the investment and we're going to take it out now that right. Joseph Chow has died. But they get the runaround for months and months and months. They just weren't getting this money.
Oh, because he broke.
So they hire an attorney, a good one, who couldn't even follow this paper trail that they gave him. He started submitting subpoenas for documents that weren't being handed over. He then called Lou's auditor, who were called Cohen and Siegel. And that's when he realized that Cohen and Siegel were just a secretarial service that would answer the phone and take a message down, and then they'd pass the messages on to Lou.
That's their whole job.
Yeah, they're supposed to be an accounting firm, but they are a secretarial service. There was no Cohen and Siegel accounting firm. It was totally fictitious. They certainly weren't certified CPAs, like it said on all these documents that he had.
Yeah.
And that's when Joseph Chow's family realized there was something seriously wrong with these investments. And then meanwhile, one of Lou's biggest investors, this guy Julian Bencher, he was getting really frustrated by the fact that he wasn't allowed to buy more of a significant stake in the airline. Even after pestering Lou, he only got about 7%. And Lou kept saying it was because Theodore Vollenkemper, the blimp guy, he was controlling most of the stock of his airline because he owned like 82% of the company. So Julian Bencher decided to fly to Germany to talk to Vollenkemper about this because by this time they were pretty friendly. And Vollenkemper was like, what are you talking about? I don't have anything to do with that airline. And Julian said that when Vollenkemper told him that, he just went cold inside because everything he'd believed for 8 years as he sank millions of dollars into Lou was a lie.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm also never going to get over people getting on a plane to go across the country for a convo. I love that move.
I mean, he went to Germany. Yeah. Go across the Atlantic.
Yeah. I'm going to just fly over here to chat with you.
Right.
I can't imagine being like just shell-shocked like that.
Right. No, I couldn't either. Lou had been sending like regular letters to his shareholders that was just glowing about how well the business was doing. He had these 40 planes, you know, in routes.
Oh, like, yeah.
It was doing great. So
I've learned firsthand that you can doctor documents to make it look like you have more money than you do.
Oh, what makes you think that's what we're talking about? So Julian looked into this. He discovered that Lou did not have a fleet of 40 planes. He actually only had 3 planes. And they didn't even really belong to Transcon, but to a company called Planet Airways that Lou had formed in 1998 that was like a small charter service.
You went from 3 to 4, not even like 13, but you're like, yeah.
40.
40. Mm-hmm.
There was no Transcontinental Airlines. It only existed on paper. But instead of exposing him, Julian handled this discovery privately and basically took hush money to keep quiet. Alan Gross, his old childhood friend from Marshall Gardens apartments, he was able to expose the lie even further when he showed the Vanity Fair journalist a photo of what appeared to be a transcontinental 747 landing at LaGuardia Airport in New York. This was the photo that Lou had on all of the brochures that he would hand out to investors. The only part of the plane that you can't see in this photo is the tail, because it's like
tail
from this way.
Which has the logo.
Which has the logo. Also, that's where Lou's fingers were. It was a model plane that Lou just held up to make it look like it was a real plane landing at LaGuardia.
No.
It was a model plane that Alan had built for him. So that's how he knew that was a model plane.
No. When you say model plane, you mean like could a sit toy. On my desk, yes. Like a paperweight. Uh-huh.
Yes.
Not like a...
Like probably a little bigger than a paperweight. Probably like maybe 2 feet long. Yeah.
That's it.
Maybe like a foot and a half.
This is scandalous. We are not working hard enough over here, because the things people are getting away with, like, in what world are you like, I'm going to take this a Hot Wheel airplane, basically, and put it again. Like, I'm not trying hard enough. I could be making a lot more money doing a lot less.
Yeah. Alan had built this model plane for him in the 70s, and Lou asked to borrow it one day, and he just held it up at the runway, snapped a pic, and people thought it was real.
Is this why Alan is in a car in a garage?
No, that was Frankie Vasquez, but yes.
Oh.
Now others are starting to wonder what's happening with their own investments, and they're starting to see the glaring red flags. This isn't just a matter of cutting corners, you know, like a little embezzling here and there.
Yeah, this is a model airplane on a brochure.
Fabricated airline. Millions of dollars in investments, and not one person had seen the planes.
This is like the 90s version of Anna Delvey. Just
Oh yeah. But like, also, wouldn't you want to like book a flight on the airline before pouring millions of dollars into something?
Oh, I mean, definitely, but
I think some of them did
that.
Who
has the time?
I think some of them did that, and Lou would like rent a plane for that trip and then say, "This is the plane I own." Like,
right. Yeah, I mean, how do you fact check it.
He also told investors that they were buying into an employee investment savings account, or an EISA, which he said was a rock solid investment with guaranteed annual returns of about 8%. He said they were guaranteed by the FDIC and the AIG, as well as Lloyd's of London, which are all basically organizations and companies designed to protect losses from investments, which I didn't know were a thing, but that's cool. Mm-hmm. He had confirmation letters and policies that he would show anyone who asked to see them. But it was all fake. None of it was insured. Not by the FDIC, the AIG, or Lloyd's. Lloyd's even got wind of this and went to complain to the SEC. But nothing ever happened. And being uninsured means that none of his investors will ever see a dime of their money again.
Oh my God.
Turns out.
But it like seems so unfair if like it's a fraud and then also the documentation for insurance is like also a fraud. Like, how would you know? You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I guess you got to call.
But like, where's the money going to come from? Nobody can pay you back. Like, the money's gone.
Yeah.
Turns out it was actually just a big Ponzi scheme. In fact, it was one of the largest and the longest running Ponzi schemes in American history. Lou freaking Pearlman. Largest and longest running Ponzi scheme in American history. This is crazy.
What's the word Ponzi mean? I know what a scheme is.
It's named after a guy named Ponzi, something Ponzi, who came up with this scheme, or he was like the first one caught doing this. But basically it just means like you use money from new investors to pay off the old investors and you keep this thing going. It's a pyramid scheme.
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd use the money from new investors to make the returns to the old ones so nobody's getting real suspicious. So long as you're bringing in money, you can keep going. You can keep living the good life.
That seems so stressful.
Yeah, well, yeah, I agree. Because in reality, there wasn't even any such thing as an EISA, this thing that he said they had, this employment, whatever.
Yeah.
People would get it confused with an ERISA, an employee retirement investment savings account, which is a real thing. And with all these acronyms these guys are slinging around, I'm not really surprised that he got away with that.
Alphabet soup over here.
Yeah, no kidding. FDIC, SEC, AIG, Lloyds of London. Thank you, Lloyds of London, for not being LOL.
O-L-O-L.
Within a little over a decade, Lou stole about $300 million worth of EISA sales that were actually completely worthless to investors. $300 million.
That's insane.
Mostly, he got away with it because he kept hiring inexperienced people as his staff. His general counsel had started out as his personal driver with duties that included handing out paper towels in a Transcon bathroom. Another one of his top employees he recruited from a convenience store. So these weren't people that were very knowledgeable about the world of investments and would be able to catch on to his crap. And they're also people that he's pulling up. So they're going to be extra loyal to him, you know?
When I worked at the Waffle House, I was approached about coming to work on a boat, on a private yacht. Mm-hmm. And I often, you know, I was like, I think you should have done that. So.
Yeah.
I know, but I'm like, what would I be part of one of these like weird, like, I was working at the Waffle House and now I'm, I don't know, wrapped
you know,
up
that in some happened to my friend. Scheme. She was bartending, like, she was waiting tables for a long time at a Papa Seafood. And then she became a bartender. And some customer came in and offered her a job at Jacobs Engineering. And she started working for Jacobs Engineering, making a lot of money. She bought a condo when she was like 22. I mean, yeah. She doesn't do that now. Now she went back to grad school and is in like restaurant management or whatever. But I mean, happens.
Could be waiting tables in Tahiti or something.
Right. But the problem with a Ponzi scheme is it's like an MLM. You have to continue bringing in new money. And after a while, you're going to run out of people. Like, where are you going to find these people from? It had been 20 years and he'd gone after anyone and everyone from the millionaires to the Florida retirees. At this point, like I said, he's in the hole something $300 million. That's what it would take to cash out his investors. Obviously, he couldn't do that. He doesn't have $300 million. So he ran. His investors became desperate for their money back, including Frankie Vasquez, who took his own life over the loss, as well as the realization that he had unknowingly actually helped Lou succeed in these crimes. Lou had been everything to Frankie.
So hard.
He would have done anything for him. He'd devoted 20 years of his life to him and was now way too entangled with him. The fallout of Lou's lies would blow back on him as well, and Frankie didn't see another way out. Before he died, he set up his computer with all the passwords, like everything that they would need to get in and get all the information they would need. And now Lou Pearlman is a fugitive with 1,700 victims left behind. 3 months after Frankie died, Lou was still on the run. In February of 2007, the FBI performed a search of all of his properties and issued a warrant for his arrest. They then launched an international manhunt for Lou Pearlman.
That is crazy. An international manhunt for the NSYNC and Backstreet Boys old manager.
Uh-huh. The like, creator of the NSYNC and Backstreet Boys. I know.
Yeah, the creator.
I know. Guy that changed my life.
Yeah.
This search was like looking for a needle in a haystack, is what they said. Which I just have a hard time believing. He's pale, orange-haired, huge. He doesn't exactly blend into
what?
A crowd, you know?
Really?
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't know what he looks like, but...
Well, he doesn't...
I mean, I know social media is not as much of a thing, but, like, yeah, I feel like you have a footprint here. Like, how are you really hiding? Like, people know you,
Yeah.
I don't know. I just feel like...
Well, but finally, 6 months later, they got a lead that included a photograph someone took of Lou at a buffet in Bali.
This just gets wilder every time. We start with, like, blimps in New York, and now we're at a buffet in Bali. Uh-huh.
The FBI was able to swoop in and quickly had him extradited to the United States. Once he was in jail, Lou just gave it all up. He pled guilty to bank, mail, and wire fraud, and he accepted a plea bargain. At his sentencing, there were so many people that showed up. Victims that wanted retribution, that were wondering how they were going to survive. He'd stolen all their money. The judge gave him 1 month for every $1 million that he stole, which was over $300 million, and it amounted...
Still feel like it should be more than a month for a milli.
But it amounted to 25 years in prison, which I think is the longest sentence I've ever heard of for white collar crime, and deservedly so. But then they'd give him a month off for every million that he was able to return. But I don't think he managed to get many months off.
That's like the Waffle House challenge. Like, for every waffle you eat, an hour you is shaved hour off take. Of your time. That's like the original.
Yeah, this is the original of that. Lou never showed any signs of remorse for all the damage that he did. He went to federal prison in Miami making plans to mount a comeback. He was making plans in prison on how to develop boy bands in prison. Which
the boy bands are dead.
Well, yeah, by 2007, they were gone. Yeah.
That makes me sad.
And
though.
Lou didn't end up serving his entire sentence because he died in prison in 2016 at the age of 62.
Oh my gosh.
Yep. And that's the story of Lou Pearlman.
Wow. Did he serve any or was there any charges about the like sexual abuse?
Because nobody would talk about it.
Right.
And like, what could Steve say? Like, he hugged me a few times and squeezed my shoulder and made me feel weird. So, you know, I mean,
yeah.
And no, but and Nick Carter wouldn't talk about what happened.
Steve.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think he ever got into the music industry.
Are Nick Carter and Aaron Carter both dead?
No, Nick Carter, he's like still performing and stuff, but Aaron died. Yeah. Aaron went a bad way. Yeah. It was really sad watching him. Yeah.
Wow. Aaron's party.
I know. He had like the biggest selling album when he was like 8 or 9. It was crazy.
If any peeps and creeps out there want to put together a boy band playlist on Spotify, that'd be really great.
Okay, who would you want to include in your boy band Spotify? What bands are a necessity? Obviously NSYNC and Backstreet Boys.
Mm-hmm.
I would want LFO. I would want 5.
O-Town. I want
98 Degrees.
90 Degrees. Oh my God. The way I was committed to that music video, I could not think of it, but it's like the wedding song. I told you, 8th grade, rose petals in the bathtub.
Oh yeah.
Boombox with that on repeat. Like I was in
this documentary that Lance Bass produced, the Boy Band Con. You can watch it on YouTube for free. It's like an hour and a half.
Yes, I will.
There's this part where this like old MTV VJ that I recognized his face because I used to watch MTV all the time at that time.
VJ. Yeah.
But I couldn't remember what this guy's name was. It wasn't Carson Daly. It was the other guy. And he's talking about how boy bands were always 5 or 3, but never 4 for some reason. And I'm like, excuse me. Did you forget about 98 Degrees?
My God. 98
Degrees had 4 members, excuse friend. Me. And yes, they were a boy band.
I'm trying to find. There's a boy band song. I can't remember it, but it's on a Princess Diaries. I think it's on the first movie, the soundtrack.
Are you talking about Rooney? Because I do love them, but I wouldn't consider them a boy band.
No, I don't know what song it is. It's Backstreet Boys. What makes you different makes you beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
By Backstreet Boys. I loved that song.
There was also Youngstown that were from Ohio. I loved them. Westlife was another one.
I was like, Youngstown is a city in Ohio. Yeah. Oh, I never heard of
that. Together. They were fictitious, but then they became real, and I'm obsessed with them. And they
is that movie?
Mm-hmm. They were basically a spoof of, like, Lou Pearlman putting together Backstreet Boys, except Lou Pearlman's name in the movie was Bob Buff or Bob Russ. Bob Russ.
Bob Ruff.
Yeah, put some together. Throw some together on that playlist, okay? Some U plus me equals us calculus. Some
I love how we just demand these requests. No one's making us a playlist, but they should.
Yeah, make us a little mixtape. They'll have fun with that. All right. Well, that's all I got for you today. That is
wow, that was
story of Lou Pearlman.
Unexpected.
What do you think? Yeah.
I love how we've like covered Kesha and Taylor Swift and NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, like
all the crimes surrounding pop music. Yeah. Britney Spears. Did you
say Britney Spears? That was a two-parter for Britney. What's she up to?
Oh, God. I don't know. Something weird, though. I mean, she just released this video. I mean, it's a little, I don't think she's totally out of the woods. She
released a video?
Yeah. It was troubling. It was.
On her Instagram?
Yeah. It was troubling. I can't remember exactly what happened.
I'll go look.
Well, that is all I have for you today. Thank you so much for listening. You can find us on Instagram at Creepers Pod. Join our Facebook discussion group, True Crime Creepers discussion group. It's really fun over there. We'd love to have you. You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/truecrimecreepers and Twitter sometimes, very occasionally. Not big over there.
I'll,
but follow
I'll get
us.
On it.
Maybe Mocap will start if people follow us.
Yeah.
And you make sure,
really, Twitter really took a turn.
Yeah. And make sure that you subscribe to True Crime Creepers so you'll know exactly when our next episode drops, when I'll tell Mocap another wild story.
Bye, bye, bye. Bye, peeps and creeps.
Bye, 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 bye.
I'm going to listen to that all night.